cozy as this. We should have a little fire right there in the middle. Warm our hands, dry off a little bit. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
Well, this is what is Floating Zendo's version of Ruhatsu Sesshin. Very, very short and not so ambitious as you will find in just about every other Zen center where at least 7 days are intensely sat with a lot of ambition. It's very hard not to have ambition because, after all, it's about Shakyamuni Buddha's experience under the Bodhi tree. And it was a good thing that happened, and so, of course, we come to the Christian and want a good thing to happen to us, too. and it's a puzzle for us how we've inherited this activity, you could say, this action, and yet it's very hard to know what it is, what it is that we're actually doing. I've been thinking a lot about our practice, having been invited by the Quakers to talk to them about Zen Buddhism. They gave me a 14-page paper written by a Japanese man called, A Zen Buddhist Encounters Quakerism. I don't know who Toryo Yaso Tamura is, but he doesn't sound like a real Zen Buddhist to me. He sat with Edo Roshi for 1 year, he says, and sat one Sesshin. So he's had a taste of it. He's read a great deal of D.T. Suzuki. And there are huge books written to refute D.T. Suzuki's analysis of Zen Buddhism, because his basic premise is that you sit in order to erase all thinking until you arrive at the point of no thought. And that's what Mr. Tamura was pressing for. He said it's very hard to do. It takes a long, long time to get there, and not many people can do it. But that is the point of Zen, is to end up not thinking at all. Well, I've been told that when they measure your brain waves and the line is straight, it means you're dead. When it's going up and down, you're thinking. The thinking is happening. And there's no way to stop thinking without not being anymore. And certainly, Buddha, under the tree, was thinking big time. If you read the stories, he wasn't just sitting there with an empty mind. He was encountering Mara over and over and over again. And I think that's the essence of our practice. It means having to face all the elements that arise in our mind, all the aggrandizement. Mara offered him power over the whole world. You can be just like Donald Trump. Own everything. And offered him the power to fight off great enemies and great wealth, unlimited wealth. And every time he would say, "I see you, Mara." And then Mara would throw up his hands and say, "He sees me," and he runs away. And that's the crucial part of it, is the willingness to acknowledge and see what rises up in us. To become familiar rather than denying or turning away. Because our denial clouds our ability to know ourselves in the deepest way. And the deepest way is not any of those Mara things. Mara exists in each of us, of course. We're greedy. We're ridiculous. We're ignorant. And yet, there's something else. We call it Buddha nature in our practice. In Quakers, a friend of mine's mother gave him the Quaker Book of Discipline. When he was, I guess she got it when he was born, and then she gave it to him later in his life. And I told him about this talk I'm supposed to give, and asked him about Quakers. And he said, "Well, just this is what it is to be a Quaker. Love, the outworking of the divine spirit, is the most potent influence that can be applied in the affairs of men. And this application of love to the whole of life is conceived to be the core of the gospel." The outworking of the divine spirit is the most potent influence that can be applied in the affairs of men. And this application of love to the whole of life is conceived to be the core of the gospel. We call it compassion. But certainly all great teachers who have come through time in this short human span of time, such a short time we've been human beings, return over and over to this one place. And this is the place that's revealed when we're honest about ourselves. This is the place that's revealed when we are willing to accept and admit the Mara nature of us. Because with that, then suddenly we're able to do that outreaching. And I think the outreach part is the most important part of that sentence. The outreach of love. And that's our practice too. So often we think people tease us, "Oh, you're just looking at your navel, you're just wasting your time, you're so self-involved," and etc., etc. And there is something to say about that, because that's part of our practice, is to encounter what this is. What the heck is going on? But the end result is, when we stand up and meet what we meet, it's with an outreaching. It's natural. I think we're born with it. That's why we call it Buddha nature. It's our nature. So Buddha's practice under the tree, at first he felt it was incomprehensible. And then he thought maybe his friends would get it. And there are many explanations and stories about what he told them. There's a brand new book out by Gil Fronsdale called Buddha Before Buddhism. And I haven't read it. I'm only reading the introduction. In it, Gil talks about early documents. There's one called the Honeyball Sutra. And then this one is even earlier than the Honeyball Sutra. It's a series of poems. And the teaching is really, really simple. It does not have the Eightfold Path. It does not have the 10 paramis. It does not have the thises and the thats and the sixes and the sevens of those. It does not have the boomies. It does not have the crossing the river or any of those things. It just has advice to not be attached to anything. And with no attachment, you will be peaceful. And you will be able to be with others because you are peaceful. No matter what. This may change the face of Buddhism in America. I don't know whether it will or not, but it just seems so radical compared to most of what we are practicing as Buddhists. Except when we studied someone like Wei Neng, who was saying the same thing. We have that basic teaching. And we have, in the beginning, it looks like there couldn't be any outcome to just really facing yourself and enduring what that is and telling Mara you see it. Then what's left? And they say that, you know, becoming bodhisattva-like is a very brave thing, because all you're left with really is that intention to simply be present for everything that is met, without holding on. We're living in a very confusing and challenging time, and I think this is one thing that will help us not to get too bewildered by it. if we stand in our own shoes, on our own piece of ground, in one sense, it's all about me. It's all about each one of you and what's in you. What you find there. Not in a good way or a bad way, because you can't really tell. Sometimes a bad thing turns out to be a good thing, and vice versa. So being attached to judgments is a kind of useless exercise. Straightforward mind is what they talk about. Cultivate a straightforward mind. Trout just emailed me an offering of a sticker to put on my car that says stand. He says we should all drive around with our cars saying stand. But it makes sense to me. I think that's what Buddha was doing too. And what we need to do, to stand in our own truth, to stand in what we know, and not be swayed by there's so much that's going on. Quakers talk about an inner light. They sit to experience an inner light, which then is part of the outreach that allows them to do what they do, the many, many things that they do. Mr. Tamura says Zen people don't do things like the Quakers do. We have no outreach. But that's not true. It's not true at all. We find ways without glorification, without headlines, without being stars. We just do what we need to do and be how we need to be with people. It makes all the difference. He also complains bitterly about the Quaker practice of standing up and speaking during the quiet time. He has all kinds of things to say about that. Thinks it's a very bad idea. But it's what they do. They've been doing it for 360 years. So what the heck? It seems to work. And we have our funny ways too. Every single human endeavor, cultural endeavor certainly, starts out in simplicity and a kind of raw truth, and then elaborates until it becomes full of bellows and laces and every kind of gaudy extra stuff. And I think the next effort after that is to come back to simplicity again and start over. And COVID brought that. He was sick and tired of Zen in Japan and said so, even though he was highly connected to the most ancient lineages and was very well known and admired for being so brilliant and being such a great master at a very young age. And yet he just thought it was folderol, most of it. Just folderol. And very political. It's very political. And when he came to America, he got first involved with San Francisco Zen Center. And it took him a while to be given the space in order to develop his own way. And his own way was just like this. Just very, very, very simple. And I've told the story before about Hachikoji. We were in the middle of a session, and suddenly these Japanese men appeared in business suits and said they were from Soto's Shu, and they were come to see Jikoji and check it out for the bishop in Los Angeles. That's what the bishop does. He sends his minions out to check everybody who's a part of Soto Shu. We were not part, are not part of Soto Shu. Koban always refused to have us sign up for that. But here were these guys checking us out, and we were just about to have lunch in the Zendo. So, of course, we invited them to come. They came with cameras on their necks. And all the time that they were serving, they were taking pictures. And then they sat down with Oreoke in front of them, and they had forgotten. It had been a long time since they'd eaten Oreoke. So it was a hard go for them. And finally, after lunch, they took Coben and me up to the picnic table, and we all sat down, just the four of us. And they started asking how much money we had, how many students we had, what kind of property we had, etc., etc. And then I told them everything that I knew. I don't think Coben even knew the answers to those questions. And then they said, in this sort of princely way, and what can we do for you? Meaning, wouldn't you like to come and join us? And Coben thought for a long time, and he said, Aheiji Temple Monastery puts out a very nice magazine. If you could send that to us, we would be very happy. So that's really our tradition. It's a little tricky because it can get kind of superior in its own weird way. Oh, we're so good, we're so simple. So it's important just to stay on a steady track and let it be what it's going to be. And if you get rich like Chogyam Trungpa and live in a beautiful house, that will show what good thing practice is. That's what he said. People will see that if you do this practice, you can have a great big house. Oh, yes. Or not. Or not. It doesn't matter. What matters is not to be caught by things. Not to think things are forever when they're just for now. Just for the moment. and not be overly surprised when they shift and change into something else. Of course we're surprised, we're always surprised. Sometimes I think life is just one big surprise after another. You think you've got it all figured out, you think you've got it all on a, just the way you want it, and boom! But there's a steady, a warm and steady place in us. Actually, it's here. Right here. That's why we hold our hands here. This is the best place to rest the hands. Because then you feel the breath. The whole belly breathes. It's a deep breath that comes and goes, and the hands are coming and going with it. And the hands are joined so that the whole energy of the body is connected. And of course, the connection goes all the way out in every direction. There's no limit. And the more we can enact this life of us, the more warmly and completely and honestly we can, the more of our outreach can reach others.